Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with author Dr. Connie Zweig, and we continue the discussion on the human shadow. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. Mass propaganda accounts. Cybersecurity spy task force. It's been common, this is by Anthony Gicciardi, it has been common knowledge to anyone paying attention within the alternative news community for years, but once again the media is now admitting that the U.S. military and intelligence agencies are indeed running massive propaganda campaigns that cover a vast array of online networks. How many times now has such conspiracy nonsense been reported years later by the mainstream media as undeniable fact? In the case of the U.S. intelligence propaganda machine that even the New York Times has covered in an article titled "The Real War on Reality," well, we're seeing just that. The New York Times report goes on to detail information uncovered from hacked data regarding the military operation to stage grassroots responses and organizations in order to deceive via psychological operations. Professor of Philosophy Peter Ludlow is quoted, quote, "The hack also revealed evidence that Team Themis was developing a persona management system, a program developed at the specific request of the U.S. Air Force that allowed one user to control multiple online identities." Quote, "Sock puppets is what they're called, for commenting in social media spaces, thus giving the appearance of grassroots support. The contract was eventually awarded to another private intelligence firm." The cyber warfare is clearly not just in the capacity of improving international reputation, as military commanders are claiming on record. Instead, we're talking about running a major network of computers that are constantly running code specifically written to post to social media and news comment pages, something that was revealed all the way back in 2011 by Raw Story and brushed off in the name of national security by the military. Here's an excerpt from a particularly concerning summary of a recent German report on how political activists are targeted. Quote, "The targets of these attacks are scientists. It does not stop at skirmishes in the scientific community. Hackers often target various web pages. Evaluation of IP log files show that not only Monsanto visits the pages regularly, but also various organizations of the U.S. government, including the military. These include the Navy Network Information Center, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the U.S. Army Intelligence Center, an institution of the U.S. Army, which trains soldiers with information gathering." Here's another story, FDA Drug Safety Communication. FDA requires label changes to warn of risk for possibly permanent nerve damage from antibacterial fluoroquinolone drugs taken by mouth or by injection. The FDA has now required the drug labels and medication guides for all fluoroquinolone antibacterial drugs be updated to better describe the serious effect of peripheral neuropathy. This serious nerve damage potentially caused by fluoroquinolones may occur soon after these drugs are taken and may be permanent. The risk of peripheral neuropathy occurs only with fluoroquinolones that are taken by mouth or by injection. Here's another story. Israeli Health Minister German signs controversial regulations not requiring local fluoridation for drinking water. As pediatricians and dentists charge that it would harm children's dental well-being, Health Minister Yael German said that municipalities and local authorities would in a year no longer have to fluoridate their drinking water. German, who previously as mayor of Herzliya opposed, quote, forcing residents to take the mineral, really, it's not a mineral, it's a chemical, with every drop they drink. Calcium fluoride is a mineral, but sodium fluoride is not. That's the industrial waste. So she said she opposed forcing residents to take fluoridated water and said there were more effective and safer ways to protect children's teeth, such as fluoride pills, toothpaste, and education. So in this article, the implication in that sentence is, please don't medicate everyone internally through the water supply. Doses of this poison affect people based on their size. Little babies are more susceptible to sodium fluoride in the drinking water than, say, a 300-pound person. She said she signed new regulations for stricter supervision of water supplies that included canceling mandatory fluoridation. She then appealed to the High Court of Justice against the Health Ministry's requirement since 2002 that water be fluoridated in every authority with at least 5,000 residents. But the Israel Pediatric Society said that bringing the National Fluoridation Project to a halt in another year, quote, is liable to harm children's dental health, adding fluoride is the safest, most efficient, and egalitarian way of reducing the prevalence of dental cavities. It also provides clear economic and social benefits. Well, this article continues. We've talked about this issue on In Other News, especially right after a city council person proposed to remove fluoride, sodium fluoride, from the drinking water. I had a couple guests on to talk about this. So let's hear a clip from Dr. Paul Conant from a number of years ago discussing the harmful effects of putting the industrial poison sodium fluoride into water supplies. Let's have a listen.
The chemical that we use to fluoridate the drinking water is actually a hazardous waste. It's derived from the phosphate fertilizer industry. It's from the two gases that used to decimate the local environment, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. And these gases are liberated when you heat up phosphate rock with sulfuric acid to make soluble phosphate for fertilizer. And for about 100 years, these gases caused a lot of environmental damage. Eventually, they were required to put scrubbers on, a spray of water. And that converts these two very toxic gases into a substance called hexafluorosilicic acid. And this is where the story gets a bit like Monty Python, because this stuff cannot be dumped into the sea by international law. And it can't be dumped locally because it's far too concentrated. But if somebody was to buy this stuff from them, it stops being labeled a hazardous waste and incidentally being protected by hazardous waste regulations. It becomes a product. And as such, it's then put into our drinking water. So if it goes into the air, it's a pollutant. If it goes into the sea, it's a pollutant. If it goes into local water near the phosphate plants, it's a pollutant. But magically, when it's put into the drinking water, it becomes safe for our kids to drink. It's absolutely preposterous, but it also saves the phosphate fertilizer a lot of money.
Even though they spend, I heard, up to $24 million a year for the process of fluoridating the water in Manhattan, Queens, and Kings County.
Yeah, well, of course, it is a very, very large water supply to America's largest city. And, of course, it would be much, much more expensive than that if they actually used pharmaceutical-grade sodium fluoride, which is an alternative. If they used the pharmaceutical grade, then they couldn't possibly do this. And that if you wanted to continue fluoridating water, the more rational and sensible way to do it would be to make out bottled water. If you did it that way, you could use pharmaceutical grade, you could control the dose because you could tell people only to drink 1 liter of the water at one part per million. And you also wouldn't be forcing it on people that didn't want to drink it. So that's the alternative for Mayor Bloomberg and the others who might get their knickers in a twist if we start suggesting that they take it out of the water.
We had Attorney Paul Bieber on before. He's the president of the New York Coalition Against the Fluoridation of Water. He had sort of listed a procedure of how to do it if you weren't a politician. And it's quite an exhausting process. Hopefully, this actually gained some traction. But in your book and in your presentation on YouTube, you can go on YouTube and find Professor Paul Conant's presentation, The Case Against Fluoride. Paul points out the toxicity levels varies, and there's 1% of human beings that are highly, highly sensitive to fluoride. Paul, could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. This is exactly what you would expect, by the way. Whenever you've got a toxic substance, people don't react in the same way. You get a whole range of sensitivity. Some people in your population will be very resistant to its toxicity. Most people have an average response, but a few people will be very, very sensitive to it. And it is about 1% of the population that do react even at these so-called low levels of one part per million. And I should say, when you start using the words like low and high, you have to tie it to some kind of base. And I think the best reference for whether fluoride levels are high or low is the level in mother's milk. The level in mother's milk can be as low as 0.004 parts per million. So when people talk about one part per million being low and not to worry about it, in actual fact, it's 250 times higher than the level in mother's milk. Or to put it another way, parents who are bottle feeding their babies right now in New York City are giving their baby 250 times more fluoride than nature intended, certainly 250 times more than a breastfed baby would get. And is that a wise thing to do? Absolutely not, especially now that we have 24 studies from China, from India, from Iran, and Mexico, which indicate an association between moderate exposures to fluoride and lowering of IQ in children. Even the promoters of fluoridation now have recognized that the predominant benefit of fluoride is topical, its benefit. It works on the outside of the tooth, on the enamel layer, on the outside of the tooth, not from inside the body. And also, we now know from studies done in the last 2 or 3 years that the most vulnerable year for developing a condition called dental fluorosis, literally poisoning of the teeth, dental fluorosis is a mottling or discoloration of the tooth enamel, which now impacts 41% of American children between the age of 12 and 15. The most vulnerable year for the development of that condition is the first year.
That was an excerpt from an interview with Dr. Paul Conant discussing the harmful effects of dumping sodium fluoride, the industrial waste, into the New York City drinking water. We continue the Shadow Project on In Other News and discuss the human shadow with Dr. Connie Zweig, founder of the Center for Shadow Work and Spiritual Counseling of AIWP. She has a doctorate in psychology, 2 years training at the Los Angeles Jung Institute, and has been in practice for 20 years. Remember Dr. Paul Dobransky's interviews and using observing ego? This is similar, yet a different approach. With Dr. Stephen Wolf, Dr. Connie Zweig has developed a method to diffuse your negative emotions, release the guilt and shame associated with them, and achieve a more trusting and authentic intimacy with others. Dr. Connie is co-author of Meeting the Shadow, The Hidden Power of the Dark Side of Human Nature, and Romancing the Shadow, Illuminating the Dark Side of the Soul. Dr. Connie has come to be known as the, quote, shadow expert, a guide who can go where others fear to tread, into your dark side. Dr. Connie Zweig joins us today. Welcome to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff.
We've talked in a previous show with Laurie Shapira, a teacher at the C.G. Jung Institute in New York City, about Carl Jung's psychological theory of the shadow. It was a general approach to the topic, looking at the individual and collective shadow aspects. I wanted to also discuss your work in teaching people how to use self-observation and help discover those hidden parts of ourselves. Can you tell listeners about that area of work you do?
Yes. Well, your previous interviewer probably spoke about Carl Jung, who coined the term shadow to refer to the personal unconscious, that part of each of us in our minds that is outside of our awareness and contains a vast treasure of material that we don't want to look at, that we don't want to identify with, that we don't see as parts of us. So the shadow might contain our anger, if that was forbidden when we were children, or our sadness, or our vitality, or our jealousy or envy, or our rage, or our athletic ability. So you can see I'm saying not all negative traits. Anything that was forbidden or taboo in our families will get repressed and stuffed into the shadow. It also could have been forbidden in school or in church, sexuality, for example. So that material gets buried inside of us and not lived out. And what Jung did is he looked at that material through his patient's dreams. And that was his road to the unconscious. Since I put together the collection Meeting the Shadow, I decided to go into a PhD program in Jungian psychology and study this further. Because, partly because that book reached so many people and touched so many people so deeply. So after I received my doctorate, I collaborated with Dr. Steve Wolf, and we wrote Romancing the Shadow. And our intention in that was to develop a methodology beyond what Jung had done with dream work to enable people to work with their own shadow material, which we call shadow work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what you're asking about, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to talk about that in more detail?
Could you describe the aspects of the shadow that come up for some of your patients that you work with?
Yeah. When we meet the shadow, we meet a part of ourselves that we dislike, that we disown, we may deny, we may find disgusting. And we meet it in different ways. So, for example, I have one client who hates this woman she works with because she's very seductive and outwardly sensual. And so my patient is uncomfortable with those qualities about this other person because her own sensuality is in the shadow, is buried inside of herself. And so when she sees it on the outside in somebody else, she thinks it's about that other person. But it's really a reflection of what she denies about her own femininity and her relationship to her body. But we might also meet the shadow in our own behavior. So I have a client who regularly gets critical and angry with his wife, and then he feels remorse afterwards because he sees that part of himself as unacceptable, and he sees that he hurts her. And so he's meeting his shadow in that behavior. Someone who struggles with addiction could be to food or drugs or alcohol or sex, doesn't matter, but who has that part that is not controllable and acts out in self-destructive ways in the addict shadow, that's somebody who's meeting a part of himself or herself that is not compatible with the self-image. That's another way to explain it. If it's incompatible with how you see yourself, you know, I'm a person who's mellow and in control, but then has 10 drinks and acts out in a crazy way.
Hmm.
So that's another way somebody might meet their shadow.
Does somebody criticizing somebody else for something they did always reflect upon that person's shadow, or could it actually be a genuine criticism on the other person?
Well, if it's a habitual and an unconscious behavior, you know, tuck in your shirt, your hair is messy, you're overweight, you look overweight, I don't like what you're eating today, I don't like how you're chewing, I don't like how you're talking to me. If it's a habitual pattern of making the other person wrong, then chances are it's about the speaker. If it's feedback that comes with an invitation, for example, I wanted to talk to you today about what you're wearing since we're going to this business event. Would you mind if we talked about it? And the other person says, okay, then it's not a shadow because it's not an uncontrolled, unconscious, habitual criticism. It's a conscious behavior. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes much more sense. I understand it. How are your patients able to transform specific shadow behavior into something that would ultimately help them evolve?
Well, I was working with a man today who's in his 40s and he's single, and he has this shadow character that he calls the shark. And the shark is basically out to get sex. When we really stay with this shadow character and explore where it comes from and what he's feeling when this shark arises, what we discover is that he's not really looking for sex. He's looking for intimacy and love. He really wants a relationship. But his habit is to go after sex. And what he realized today is that that was actually sabotaging his deeper intention, which is to find love. And that acting like a shark and picking up women and having sex right away was not building the foundation for a relationship, which is his deeper desire. And yet, the good thing about it, what I call the gold in the dark side, the gold in the shark shadow, is that it's motivating him to connect with women. So there's something useful about it. But the way that he's going about it is actually sabotaging himself. And we could say that with any shadow figure. So, for example, someone is eating ice cream at night and gaining weight and very, very unhappy with herself about the behavior and the result. Okay. Now, it looks on the surface like the behavior is about food. And so we call this shadow the foodie. And when we started to explore it more deeply, and when I asked her to observe every night, what is she thinking and what is she feeling when she eats the ice cream? What's underneath that behavior? What she said is, I really want to call my boyfriend and tell him I feel disconnected and I don't like what's happening between us. But I can't do it. I'm too scared, so I eat. Oh, this is what my mother did. I watched my mother do this with my dad, and she got really fat and overweight and depressed because she couldn't communicate with him. So I said to her, well, what stops you from calling your boyfriend and telling him how you feel? Well, he'll reject and abandon me. I said, well, which is worse, that you find out that you lose him, you find out he doesn't really care about you, and then you're single, or you're stuffing those feelings and eating and hurting your health? And she said, okay, now I can see that I need to talk to him. And this happens over weeks. You know, this doesn't happen in a minute. It takes time. It goes slowly. So she picked up the phone, and she called him, and she said, you know, I'm uncomfortable that we say we're in a relationship and we only talk to each other or see each other once a week, and I don't know what's going on in the rest of your life, and I don't know if you're seeing other people. And he said, you know, I'm not happy in this relationship. I'm seeing other people, and I think it's time for us to separate. So she had a few nights of being really sad, and then she realized this wasn't right. She was actually stuffing her feelings and overeating because she couldn't communicate to this guy out of fear, and what she really needed was to know the truth. And once she was able to do that and get through the loss, she realized that she would be able to communicate the next time what was going on with her and break the pattern of eating instead of talking about her feelings. So that's the promise of shadow work. The promise is to be able to know yourself more deeply and to communicate more honestly and to give up self-destructive patterns and have better relationships.
Just to learn about this area of psychology, you know, certainly from reading your book, Meeting the Shadow, a lot of people can benefit from it. And as you pointed out, with relationships, and if somebody does their own work in observing this part of themselves and getting, you know, to... the underlying area that is, I guess, feeding the destructive behavior, and it helps them, they might be able to see it in their partner as well, another part of it.
Mm-hmm. It's always very tricky to point out unconscious process in somebody else, because if they're unconscious of it, they're unaware of it by definition, there isn't a way to really prove it. And so if you want to speak to someone, if you want to give someone a reflection like that, you have to really have an invitation. You have to really be sure that they're receptive to it. Otherwise, their defenses, their resistances will quickly come up. Does that make sense?
Completely. Where have you seen the shadow come up in relationships, in marriages? What are some resolutions that you've discovered in those areas by helping people?
You know, I'm working with people all over the world now on Skype. And so people can do shadow work without any limitation to the location they're in that way. And I've been working with both individuals and couples in Europe and the Middle East and Australia. Some couples have cultural issues. And some couples have early family childhood issues that they bring to the relationship. And some couples have differences in values and lifestyle choices. Some couples have differences around child rearing. And all of these issues are related to the individual shadow in the sense that each of us brings our own childhood wounds and injuries into a marriage. And many people, especially in a first long-term relationship, marry someone who's like the opposite sex parent. So if a man marries someone who's like his mother, or a woman marries someone who's like her father, they're going to have a lot of shadow issues that are connected to those early relationships. And it has to be unwound. In other words, a woman is going to have to work out some of her issues with her dad in order to live differently with her husband. So that's part of what I do.
Our guest is Dr. Connie Zweig. And we're talking about the human shadow. We'll be right back after this break. Just tuning in, we're speaking with author Dr. Connie Zweig about the human shadow.
In many marriages, there's a lot of projection. So projection means that we attribute something in our own unconscious to the other person. So let's say, for example, a woman sees her husband as controlling, bossy. And she realizes that her father used to be controlling and bossy. Some of the time he was really kind and generous, and so was her husband. But in the shadow of the father and the husband, there was this really controlling part. So So she's naturally attracted to this guy because it feels familiar to her. Love is what we experienced in our childhood, and if the father's love came through as kind and generous, but then sometimes bossy, that's the pattern that's familiar to this woman, that's associated with love, and she'll be attracted to that. So now she's experiencing her father issues with her husband. And the trick is to find out how much of it is about her projections and her father's shadow, and how much of it is accurate. How much does the projection fit that her husband is really being controlling and bossy with her, and how much of it is just her feelings?
Do you have to have the husband and wife together on this to find out, to verify?
Sometimes people want to work alone, and sometimes they want to work with each other.
The tricky part that you mentioned about verifying whether it's a projection or not, and I'm wondering if you go to the husband, for example, to do a quick assessment to see if those traits are there.
Okay, so I have a couple right now. They've been together 16 years, and they separated. So they each went to individual therapists first. And they liked them. They have a good fit. They're working with their therapist. And then they decided they wanted to work together, and they got referred to me. So I'm the third therapist in this situation. And the work that I'm doing with them as a couple is different from what they're doing individually. And in a way, that's the ideal way to do it, because they're each getting their own private support to look inside. And then with me, they're working on what comes up in the relationship, why they separated, where they're suffering, where they're not getting their needs met, where they're not communicating properly. So couples work is different from individual work.
I got you. This is a very fascinating area with relationships, in that you had mentioned in a previous interview the importance of when a relationship is having difficulty in their, I suppose, habitual arguments, that it is important for the couples to recognize each other's shadow aspects and be nurturing toward that and help each other work through them.
Yeah. Most marriages are pretty unconscious. You know, people are acting out old patterns and often functioning at a superficial level to make their financial goals and to have kids and have a family and own a home. But if you're oriented to the inner world and you want a conscious relationship, then, you know, my term for that is a shadow marriage. And what I mean by that is that you actually make a vow, just as you vow to honor the rest of your partner, you make a vow to honor his or her shadow figures as they come up, and to support each other to consciously work through them, whatever they are. So then you have a marriage that includes unconscious feelings and behaviors that for most people just get acted out without awareness. So that's really what I call a shadow marriage or a conscious marriage.
And a related issue, you had mentioned Robert Bly's book, a little book on the human shadow, in the interview with Jeffrey Mishlove, which is a great interview, by the way. Robert Bly's response to the money shadow and bankers and businessmen, and it's relevant in these past couple of years economically. But in a, I guess, in a marriage, in I suppose in the collective, in the business world, can you talk a little bit about what you've discovered about money and the shadow?
Well, the bottom line is that money is more taboo than sex or anything else. It's an extremely taboo subject, even in people who are very intimate with each other. And it's very charged. And that's why when we wrote Romancing the Shadow, we have a section about the money shadow in every single chapter. We have a section about money, sex, and power in every chapter, because in all the different domains of life, money, you know, plays an unconscious role, an oversized role. And I think that it's the source of a lot of conflict in relationships. And sometimes it reflects power shadow differences. Sometimes it reflects the level of commitment that people have to each other. So, for example, I have couples in my practice who have an emotional marriage and a sexual marriage and even a spiritual marriage, but they don't have a financial marriage. They don't want to join their money. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm just saying it's interesting. Money is also comes up around children and families and building a life together, in the sense that sometimes people are spenders and sometimes they're savers, and there's issues around that. Sometimes people hide money from each other and don't want to tell where it's going. Sometimes people feel the burden of being a provider, and all sorts of shadow issues come up around responsibility or resentment that the other person's not equally responsible for earning money. There's all kinds of ways that our family, our early childhood associations with money come up in our adulthood and then conflict with other people. For some people, money is evil. For other people, they spend their entire lives basically circling around money. Money is the symbol of heaven, success, wealth, potential, you know, self-esteem. So it's very weighted in our culture. It's not just about the numbers in the bank. It's a potent symbol, and it's very influenced by what our families said about it, how our families related to it and valued it or didn't value it. And there's a lot of cultural issues in here too, because I know I've got a lot of female clients who have a shadow who's a homeless bag lady, because there's such a fear of being alone and poor and on the street in our culture. Hmm. So money is an unconscious driver, motivator. And when two people come together, if they don't talk about that, if they don't know each other intimately around money, they're going to have problems.
Can we project onto money? Isn't it a state of mind where you feel wealthy or poor? As you pointed out, it's numbers in the bank. And is that a projection?
Well, it's a projection onto a symbol rather than a person. But it is. It's a way of unconsciously attributing meaning and power or problems or scarcity onto a symbol and then believing it, taking it literally. And, you know, the truth is that when you read about really wealthy people, they're not necessarily happy. You know, the money and the success doesn't automatically bring happiness. It might bring a certain freedom from worry.
Mm-hmm. Or comfort.
And it might bring comfort, material comfort. But it's not the answer that our culture tells us it is. And people who spend their lives basically trying to make money in order to feel safe are not looking deeply enough inside at what's driving them, what the money is really about, and what it is they really want. I think what I'm trying to say here is that all of us carry around inside, in the shadow, hidden values and hidden meanings that we attribute to things unknowingly, unthinkingly. And when we start to take them, you know, out of Robert Bly's long black bag and examine them in the light of day, we might be surprised. We might really be surprised.
I was thinking about evolutionary biology, and are shadow aspects also thought of in an evolutionary biological context as maybe genetic residue from animals or wild monkeys?
Well, you know, this is speculation because evolutionary biologists, I don't think, would talk about an unconscious. But, so it's kind of you're kind of mixing frames.
Mm-hmm.
Jung referred to the collective unconscious, which is not the shadow. You could call it the collective shadow. It's not the personal shadow. But it is the part of us that contains our animal heritage, our instinctual, kind of more closer to biological. I don't know if it's genetic. I don't know that I would reduce it to genes, but it's certainly a part of us that we share with animals because we basically are highly evolved animals. You could talk about it as the limbic brain. I think that's been referred to more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the limbic brain, there's very primal, instinctual desires, aggression, fight or flight, killer instinct, all of that kind of stuff. So that's in all of us. It's not really where I work. It's not sort of the level that I work with in shadow work.
The shadow is coming up for some people because of unmet needs. These are basic needs that are being repressed in a civilized society that may not accept these particular behaviors. So they're repressed, but they're more animalistic.
Yeah, well, you know, our sexuality, our aggression, our rage, we could say they're animalistic, but they're certainly very human, too. Are they primitive? Are they more primitive, less developed, less civilized? You know, there's a whole sort of value-laden judgment there on them.
Right.
I work with sort of people who are struggling with ordinary feelings, depression, anxiety, addiction, anger, that, you know, in their families could not be tolerated. And for a lot of people, it's their aliveness. Parents tend to shut down little kids when they have a lot of vitality. You know, so is that animalistic? It's just aliveness.
That's sort of where I was going, but as you pointed out, this is mixing frames. You have evolutionary biology, and I wondered if it was some kind of residue from an evolutionary standpoint, but it's also within a, you know, a social context of being human. Let's go back to Robert Bly's book, and I'm so glad that you referenced it in that interview with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove. That was really interesting. I didn't know he wrote this book. It really is amazing. And there's an excerpt in there about projection in a marriage. And he writes, "It's threatening when the projection starts to rattle. Let's suppose a woman has put a giant's mask firmly on her husband's face and feels it as a painful relief. At least she gets it out of her psyche. But what if her husband fails one day to be a negative patriarch? What to do then? Trouble. She might, unconsciously, of course, overdraw her checking account, lose bills, dent the fender, feel victimized, act like a little girl. That may turn him into a tyrant again, or she may go into a feminist meeting to get revved up. Hopefully, someone there will explain that even men's kindness are a subtle part of their oppression. When she gets home, he has the patriarch mask on again." Can you explain what Robert Bly is talking about?
Yeah, you know, Robert, when he wrote that book, was very involved in developing the men's movement. And so he was very concerned about projections onto men of dark power, because he was wrestling with the consequences of that in these men. So what he was saying is that in a lot of couples, women project a kind of power onto their partners that the men are not really carrying, that it's in the women's minds. And it comes from their fathers, particularly. It could come from teachers or priests or other male figures, but mostly from their fathers. And for a certain amount of time, when people get together, a projection fits. So, for example, she projects the power onto him, and he projects the powerlessness onto her, and they have a match. And he's in charge, and she's accommodating, and she follows him, and he makes the decisions, right? And so they are enacting each other's projections. And it looks for a while like it's a good relationship. And then one of two things happens. Either he doesn't want all that responsibility anymore and he wants a full partner, or she starts to feel her own power and is no longer satisfied with her subordinate position. And so the projection rattles. Because it rattles because that little fit that they've made is no longer working. And either how he sees her starts to shift or how she sees him starts to shift. And at that point, they need to uncover the old patterns and try to build a new dynamic. Otherwise, the relationship falls apart. If people only see this outwardly, if they only see it as roles, which is how most people see it, that's why we have, you know, more than 50% divorce rate. It's not roles. It's internal. It's internal shadow figures being projected onto the other person. And when the person no longer carries that projection, the whole thing falls apart.
And you're suggesting going back to the original role to resolve what had broken down.
It's often in that situation, because we're in a patriarchal culture, that the woman starts to become empowered and then the whole thing starts to fall apart. But what I'm suggesting is that's the time for inner work. When the equilibrium that they've established starts to shake, and you look at each other, each of them looks at the other and says, who the hell am I with? Who are you? You're not the person I married. Then there's an incredible opportunity there for growth and development. It doesn't have to be the end of the marriage at that point. A new marriage can be created. I'm working with a number of couples now. We call it relationship number two. And they're basically rebuilding the patterns of connecting with each other in a more conscious way.
It must be quite remarkable to do this work. Getting back to the individual, going into the gold, you had termed it that certain part of the shadow, a certain percentage of the shadow is gold. And it's very difficult for people, as you have pointed out, individuals, to look at parts of their behavior that come up. But how important is it to examine this in terms of maybe for an artist who is has to use his or her creativity? How important would it be to look at this area?
You know, I'm working with a woman in her 60s who's been a CPA, certified public accountant, for her whole career, and she's dreamed of painting. And now she has enough money, she can retire, and and she's really struggling with how to set up her life so that she can paint, because it's a shift in identity. It's a shift in priorities and values. It's a shift in lifestyle. It's a shift in so many ways. And internally, what it means is that her dream, since she was a teenager, of being a painter, has been buried. It's been in the shadow. And for her to kind of begin to live that out in her 60s requires, it doesn't just require picking up a brush. It requires her to allow herself to deeply change, to accept how she's lived her life as a CPA, to work through the regret about not being an artist, to live in a place that has beauty, you know, so that she's inspired, to rearrange her relationship so that it supports this. There's a lot of change required in order to take a shadow character like this out of the dark and bring it into the light. Mm-hmm. And some people never do it. You know, some people might die with that dream unlived. Jung spoke about the unlived life. And I think many people have dreams that go unlived, dreams of traveling, dreams of being single or of being married, dreams of having kids or not having kids, you know, dreams of self-expression and dreams of writing a novel, whatever it is. When you really become conscious of the unlived life or the road not taken, you know, you have a choice then of what to do about it.
Right. You often hear, don't die with your music in you.
Yes, that's right. So I'm working with a man who's a property manager, and he's always wanted to be a singer-songwriter. And he's writing songs now. He's trying to build this bridge between these two parts of himself, but he's still kind of terrified of performing. So, you know, slowly, slowly, bit by bit, this singer-songwriter is coming out of the shadow.
That shadow area seems to be a more or a less destructive part. And it reminds me of this other question about the discussions of projecting your shadow onto others and more of the shortcomings. Could you talk about projecting positive things onto a person or a thing that is also a shadow issue?
Well, sometimes it's called the positive shadow or the golden shadow or the light shadow. We attribute, let's say, with spiritual teachers, we attribute to them all of the qualities that we think we don't have in ourselves. The consciousness or the evolution, the compassion, the wisdom, you know, the patience, that we imagine we don't contain, and so we place it outside of ourselves onto them. And, you know, in the last few decades, we've seen a lot of these spiritual teachers act out their shadows in very destructive ways. And I believe part of the reason for that, I wrote about this in The Holy Longing. I wrote a whole book about this. And I think that part of the reason for that is it's actually a heavy weight to carry all of that positive projection.
Really?
From a whole, yeah. Hmm. You got a whole group of people idealizing you, and you're human, no matter how evolved you are. You're human. You have flaws and limits, and you know what I'm saying? You go to the bathroom, and you're a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a weight in carrying a positive shadow just as there's a weight in carrying a negative shadow. And I think that there's a yearning in all of us to find someone we can idealize like that. But in the end, projection is projection. And human beings are human. And, you know, people also do that when they fall in love. It's a similar process. When you fall in love and you project all these positive qualities, you know, she's the one. She's perfect.
Dr. Connie Zweig, this is such a fascinating area that we'll continue to explore on this show. And it just really seems to lead this exploration of the shadow, the individual shadow, seems to lead toward a more compassionate life and understanding oneself. You're the author of Meeting the Shadow, The Hidden Power of the Dark Side of Human Nature, and Romancing the Shadow, Illuminating the Dark Side of the Soul, and also the book The Holy Longing. You're known as the shadow expert. Can you tell listeners how to get in touch with you?
Yes, you can find me if you're interested in doing your own shadow work, either on the phone or on Skype. I'm available at Connie Zweig, CONNIEZWEIG.com, or you can email me at ConnieZweig@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Well, Connie, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Jeff, thank you for having me. It was a wonderful interview.
I've got a feeling deep inside, oh yeah.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m. Quick reminder, the Global March on Geoengineering this coming Sunday, August 25th. You can type Global March on Geoengineering August 25th into a search engine and find a local group that's participating in the march.
like a melody. Let's go on.